Chapter 1. Sunshine or Noir. Los Angeles Intellectuals. An Introduction. Los Angeles, it should be understood, is not a mere city. On the contrary, it is and has been since 1888 a commodity, something to be advertised and sold to the people of the United States like automobiles, cigarettes, and mouthwash. Moro Mayo. In the summer of 1989, a well-known fashion magazine, constantly on the prowl for lifestyle trends, reported from Los Angeles that intellectualism had arrived there as the latest fad. From celebrities buying armloads of smart-looking eyeglasses to the people of LA who have elevated intellectualism to a lifestyle, the city was supposedly booming with bookish behavior for its own sake. There's a real feeling here about becoming intellectual, removing superficiality, getting culture. The magazine's West Coast editor noted approvingly that the new intellectualism was sweeping Los Angeles on the same wave of messianic hype that had brought its local predecessors, The Perfect Body, and New Age Spirituality. Angelinos, moreover, had already recognized that the crucial point of the new pastime was that books are for sale, and that a surge of commodity fetishism and feverish entrepreneurship would accompany the laying on of culture. As this anecdote implies, to evoke Los Angeles intellectuals is to invite immediate incredulity, if not mirth. Better, then, at the outset, to refer to a mythology, the destruction of intellectual sensibility in the sun-baked plains of Los Angeles, that conforms more to received impressions, and that is at least partially true. First of all, Los Angeles is usually seen as peculiarly infertile cultural soil, unable to produce, to this day, any homegrown intelligentsia. Unlike San Francisco, which has generated a distinctive cultural history from the Argonauts to the Beats, Los Angeles's truly indigenous intellectual history seems a barren shelf. Yet, for even more peculiar reasons, this essentially deracinated city has become the world capital of an immense culture industry, which since the 1920s has imported myriads of the most talented writers, filmmakers, artists, and visionaries. Similarly, since the 1940s, the Southern California aerospace industry and its satellite think tanks have assembled the Earth's largest single concentration of PhD scientists and engineers. In Los Angeles, immigrant mental labor is collectivized in huge apparatuses and directly consumed by big capital. Almost everyone is either on a corporate payroll or waiting hopefully at the studio gate. Such relations of pure capitalism, of course, are seen as invariably destructive of the identity of true intellectuals, still self-defined as artisans or rentiers of their own unique mental productions. Snared in the nets of Hollywood or entrapped by the strange Lovian logic of the missile industry, seduced talents are wasted, prostituted, trivialized, or destroyed. To move to Lotus Land is to sever connection with national reality, to lose historical and experiential footing, to surrender critical distance and to submerge oneself in spectacle and fraud. Fused into a single montage image are Fitzgerald reduced to a drunken hack, West rushing to his own apocalypse, thinking it a dinner party, Faulkner rewriting second-rate scripts, Brecht raging against the mutilation of his work, the Hollywood Ten on their way to prison, Didion on the verge of a nervous breakdown, and so on. Los Angeles, and its alter ego, Hollywood, becomes the literalized mahogany, city of seduction and defeat, the antipode to critical intelligence. Yet this very rhetoric, which infuses a long tradition of writing about Los Angeles since at least the 1920s, indicates powerful critical energies at work. For if Los Angeles has become the archetypal site of massive and unprotesting subordination of industrialized intelligentsias to the programs of capital, it has also been fertile soil for some of the most acute critiques of the culture of late capitalism, and particularly of the tendential degeneration of its middle strata, a persistent theme from Nathaniel West to Robert Towne. The most outstanding example is the complex corpus of what we call noir, literary and cinematic. a fantastic convergence of American tough guy realism, Weimar expressionism, and existentialized Marxism, all focused on unmasking a bright, guilty place, Wells called Los Angeles. Los Angeles, in this instance, is, of course, a stand-in for capitalism in general. The ultimate world historical significance and oddity of Los Angeles is that it has come to play the double role of utopia and dystopia for advanced capitalism. The same place, as Brecht noted, symbolized both heaven and hell. Correspondingly, it is the essential destination on the itinerary of any late 20th century intellectual, who must eventually come to take a peep and render some opinion on whether Los Angeles brings it all together, official slogan, or is, rather, the nightmare at the terminus of American history, as depicted in noir. Los Angeles, far more than New York, Paris, or Tokyo, polarizes debate. It is the terrain and subject of fierce ideological struggle. With apologies for the schematic compression inevitable in so cursory a survey, I explore first the role played by successive migrations of intellectuals, whether as tourists, exiles, or hired hands, in relation to the dominating cultural institutions of their time, the Los Angeles Times, Hollywood, and most recently an emergent university museum mega-complex, in constructing or deconstructing the mythography of Los Angeles. I am interested, in other words, not so much in the history of culture produced in Los Angeles as the history of culture produced about Los Angeles, especially where that has become a material force in the city's actual evolution. As Michael Sorkin has emphasized, L.A. is probably the most mediated town in America, nearly unviewable save through the fictive scrim of its mythologizers. I begin with the so-called Arroyo set. Writers, antiquarians, and publicists under the influence of Charles Fletcher Lummis, himself in the pay of the Times and the Chamber of Commerce, who at the turn of the century created a comprehensive fiction of Southern California as the promised land of a millenarian Anglo-Saxon racial odyssey. They inserted a Mediterraneanized idol of New England life into the perfumed ruins of an innocent but inferior Spanish culture. In doing so, they wrote the script for the giant real estate speculations of the early 20th century that transformed Los Angeles from small town to metropolis. Their imagery, motifs, values, and legends were in turn endlessly reproduced by Hollywood, while continuing to be incorporated into the ersatz landscapes of suburban Southern California. As the Depression shattered broad strata of the dream-addicted Los Angeles middle classes, it also gathered together in Hollywood an extraordinary colony of hard-boiled American novelists and anti-fascist European exiles. Together, they radically reworked the metaphorical figure of the city, using the crisis of the middle class, rarely the workers or the poor, to expose how the dream had become nightmare. Although only a few works directly attacked the studio system, noir everywhere insinuated contempt for a depraved business culture, while it simultaneously searched for a critical mode of writing or filmmaking within it. Although some principal noir auteurs, like Chandler, went little further than generalized petty bourgeois resentment against the collapse of the Southern California dream, most claimed popular front sympathies, and some, like Wells and Mitrick, alluded to the repressed reality of class struggle. Despite the post-war witch hunt that decimated Hollywood progressives, noir survived through the 1950s, to reemerge in a new wave in the 1960s and 1970s. The huge popularity of Didion, Dunn, Wamba, Chinatown, Blade Runner, the Chandler and Kane remix, and finally the arrival of the post-noir of James Ellroy's Los Angeles Quartet, stand as proof of the genre's durability. Although recuperated as an ambiance, shorn of its 1940s radical affinities, noir has nonetheless remained the popular and, despite its intended elitism, populist anti-myth of Los Angeles. While the cinematic translation of the noir vision of Los Angeles engaged some of the finest European writers and directors resident in Hollywood in the 1940s, giving them an invaluable medium for political and aesthetic resistance, the relationship between the city and the community of anti-fascist exiles deserves separate consideration. It was a potent common moment in the cultural histories of Southern California and Europe, generating its own mythology that helped shape critical reaction to the post-war Americanization of Europe. Without necessarily subscribing to the nightmare anti-myth of noir, the exile sense of Los Angeles was unremittingly pessimistic. Here was the ultimate city of capital, lustrous and superficial, negating every classical value of European urbanity. Driven by one epical defeat of the Enlightenment on the shores of Santa Monica Bay, the most unhappy of the exiles thought they discerned a second defeat in Los Angeles as the shape of things to come, a mirror of capitalism's future. It is hard to exaggerate the damage which noir's dystopianization of Los Angeles, together with the exiles' denunciation of its counterfeit urbanity, inflicted upon the accumulated ideological capital of the region's boosters. Noir, often in illicit alliance with San Francisco or New York elitism, made Los Angeles the city that American intellectuals love to hate, although, paradoxically, this seems only to increase its fascination for post-war European, especially British and French, intellectuals. As Richard Lehan has emphasized, probably no city in the Western world has a more negative image. To repair this image, especially among the cultural elites, local corporate patrons have sponsored a third major immigration of intellectuals, comparable to the Hollywood-bound diaspora of the 1930s, but now dominated by architects, designers, artists, and culture theorists. As Los Angeles, propelled by financial, real estate, and military booms, has rushed forward to Manhattanize its skylines, increasingly with offshore capital, it has attempted to Manhattanize its cultural superstructure as well. The largest land developers and bankers have coordinated a major cultural offensive, whose impact has been redoubled after decades of mere talk, by a sudden torrent of arts capital, including the incredible $3 billion Getty Endowment, the largest in history. As a result, a wealthy institutional matrix has coalesced, integrating elite university faculties, museums, the arts press and foundations, single-mindedly directed toward the creation of a cultural monumentality to support the sale of the city to overseas investors and affluent immigrants. In this sense, the cultural history of the 1980s recapitulated the real estate arts nexus of early 20th century boosterism, although this time around with a promotional budget so large that it could afford to buy the international celebrity architects, painters, and designers, Meyer, Graves, Hockney, and so on, capable of giving cultural prestige and a happy pop veneer to the emergence of the world city. These, then, are the three major collectivized interventions by intellectuals in the culture formation of Los Angeles, what I somewhat awkwardly abbreviate as the boosters, the noirs, and the mercenaries. The exiles, as a fourth, more parenthetical intervention, have linked the indigenous process of city myth production and its noirish antipode to European sensibilities about America and its West Coast. They have integrated the specter of Los Angeles into fundamental debates about the fate of modernism and the future of a post-war Europe dominated by American Fordism. It may be objected that this historical typology is one-sidedly slanted towards literateurs, filmmakers, musicians, and artists, that is, toward fabricators of the spectacle, and neglects the role of practical intellectuals, planners, engineers, and politicians, who actually build cities. And where are the scientists, Southern California's most precious crop, who have shaped its rocket-propelled post-war economy? In fact, the fate of science in Los Angeles exemplifies the role reversal between practical reason and what Disneyites call imagineering. Where one might have expected the presence of the world's largest scientific and engineering community to cultivate a regional enlightenment, science has consorted instead with pulp fiction, vulgar psychology, and even Satanism to create yet another layer of California cultdom. This ironic double transfiguration of science into science fiction and science fiction into religion is considered in a brief account of The Sorcerers. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the paramount axis of cultural conflict in Los Angeles has always been about the construction, interpretation of the city myth, which enters the material landscape as a design for speculation and domination, as Alan Seeger suggests, not as fantasy imagined, but as fantasy seen. Even though Los Angeles's emergence from the desert has been an artifact of giant public works, city building has otherwise been left to the anarchy of market forces, with only rare interventions by the state, social movements, or public leaders. The city's most Promethean figure, water engineer William Mulholland, was enigmatic and taciturn to an extreme. His collected works, the Los Angeles Aqueduct, and the injunction, "Take it." Although, as we briefly note, residential architecture has episodically served as a rallying point for cultural regionalism, for example, the Craftsman Bungalow of the 1910s, the Case Study Home of the 1940s, the Gary House of the 1970s, celluloid or the electronic screen have remained the dominant media of the region's self-expression. Compared to other great cities, Los Angeles may be planned or designed in a very fragmentary sense, primarily at the level of its infrastructure, but it is infinitely envisioned. Yet we must avoid the idea that Los Angeles is ultimately just the mirror of Narcissus, or a huge disturbance in the Maxwellian ether. Beyond its myriad rhetorics and mirages, it can be presumed that the city actually exists. I thus treat, within the master dialectic of sunshine and noir, three attempts in successive generations to establish authentic epistemologies for Los Angeles. First, and at some length in the section called Debunkers, I examine immigrant writer Louis Adamick's anti-romantic insistence upon the centrality of class violence in the constitution of the social and cultural landscapes of Los Angeles, an interpretation that was carried further in detail and scope by his close friend, Kerry McWilliams. McWilliams's Southern California Country, An Island on the Land, is analyzed as the climax and terminus of popular front attempts to unmask booster mythology and to recover the historical roles of labor and oppressed minority groups. Second, I survey the careers of several very different avant-gardes: the Black Arts Movement, the Ferris Gallery Group, the alternative Hollywood of Kenneth Anger, the solo flight of Thomas Pynchon, which formed a Los Angeles cultural underground during part or all of the 1960s. These collaborations, comunal, broken up or expatriated by the early 1970s, represented the coming of age of the first LA-bred Bohemia, indeed in some cases tracing their roots back to local high school cliques of the 1940s, unified in their autobiographical search for representative phenomenologies of daily life in Southern California in experiences as different as those of Black jazz musicians, white hot rodders, and gay bikers. Thirdly, in a concluding section, I sketch in broad and very tentative outline the fledgling attempts, after an intellectual cultural hiatus in the 1970s, to contest the current corporate celebration of postmodern Los Angeles. I argue that neither the neo-Marxist academics of the Los Angeles School nor the community intellectuals of gangster rap have yet fully disengaged themselves from the official dream machinery. On the other hand, the cultural definition of the polyethnic Los Angeles of the year 2000 has barely begun. The Boosters. The Missions are, next to our climate and its consequences, the best capital Southern California has. Charles Fletcher Lummis. In 1884, a malarial journalist from Chillicothe, Ohio, decided to change his fortune and improve his health by going to Southern California. Unlike the thousands of other health seekers beginning to discover the curative powers of sunshine, Charles Fletcher Lummis did not take the train. He walked. On his arrival in Los Angeles 143 days later, the owner of the Times, Colonel, later General, Harrison Gray Otis, was so impressed that he appointed Lummis city editor. When Otis greeted the footsore Lummis, Los Angeles was just a backcountry town, the 187th largest in the 1880 census, tributary to Imperial San Francisco, with little water or capital and no coal or port. When Otis died 35 years later, Los Angeles was the biggest city in the West, approaching a million inhabitants, with an artificial river tapped from the Sierras, a federally subsidized harbor, an oil bonanza, and block after block of skyscrapers under construction. Unlike other American cities that maximized their comparative advantages as crossroads, capitals, seaports, or manufacturing centers, Los Angeles was first and above all the creature of real estate capitalism. The culminating speculation, in fact, of the generations of boosters and promoters who had subdivided and sold the West from the Cumberland Gap to the Pacific. The first boom occurred a few years after Lummis's arrival and brought 100,000 fortune and health seekers to Los Angeles County. After the collapse of this railroad-engineered land rush, Colonel Otis, representing the toughest of the new settlers, took command of the city's business organizations on behalf of panic-stricken speculators. To revive the boom and to launch a reckless competition with San Francisco, the most unionized city in the world, he militarized industrial relations in Los Angeles. Existing unions were locked out, picketing was virtually outlawed, and dissidents were terrorized. With sunshine and the open shop as their main assets, and allied with the great transcontinental railroads, the region's largest landowners, a syndicate of developers, bankers, and transport magnates led by Otis and his son-in-law Harry Chandler set out to sell Los Angeles, as no city had ever been sold, to the restless but affluent babbitry of the Middle West. For more than a quarter century, an unprecedented mass migration of retired farmers, small-town dentists, wealthy spinsters, tubercular schoolteachers, petty stock speculators, Iowa lawyers, and devotees of the Chautauqua Circuit transferred their savings and small fortunes into Southern California real estate. This massive flow of wealth between regions produced population, income, and consumption structures seemingly out of all proportion to Los Angeles's actual production base, the paradox of the first post-industrial city in its pre-industrial guise. As Kevin Starr emphasizes in his widely acclaimed account of the cultural history of Southern California in the Booster Era, 1885 to 1925, Inventing the Dream, this transformation required the continuous interaction of myth-making and literary invention with a crude promotion of land values and health cures. In his view, the partnership of Lummis and Otis was the prototype for the conscription of a whole generation of Eastern, usually Brahmin, intellectuals as the cultural agents of the boom. The original cadre consisted of the journalists and errant literateurs led by Lummis, whom Otis brought to the Times during the Gilded Age, Robert Burdett, John Stephen McGrody, the poet of the Verdugo Hills, Harry Carr, and others. Through the talents of such men, Otis promoted an image of Southern California that dominated the popular imagination at the turn of the century, and is alive to this day, a mélange of mission myth originating in Helen Hunt Jackson's Ramona, obsession with climate, political conservatism, symbolized in open shop, and a thinly veiled racialism, all put to the service of boosterism and oligarchy. The mission literature depicted the history of race relations as a pastoral ritual of obedience and paternalism, graceful Indians, happy as peasants in an Italian opera, knelt dutifully before the Franciscans to receive the baptism of a superior culture, while in the background, the Angelus tolled from a swallow-guarded campanile, and a choir of friars intoned the Te Deum. Any intimation of the brutality inherent in the forced labor system of the missions and haciendas, not to speak of the racial terrorism and lynchings that made early Anglo-ruled Los Angeles the most violent town in the West during the 1860s and 1870s, was suppressed. If Jackson's Ramona transformed selected elements of local history into romantic myth, still popular to this day, Lummis was the impresario who promoted the myth as the motif of an entire artificial landscape. In 1894, as federal troops occupied Los Angeles and Otis fretted that the local Pullman strikers might draw out other workers in a general strike, Lummis organized the first Los Angeles fiesta as a public distraction. The next year, with the class war temporarily abated, he orchestrated the fiesta around a comprehensive mission theme, influenced by Ramona. Its electric regional impact can only be compared to the national frisson of the contemporary Columbian Exposition in Chicago, As the latter inaugurated the neoclassical revival, the former launched an equally frenzied local mission revival. The romanticized and idyllic theme was quickly picked up and exploited by a gallery of entrepreneurs who knew a good thing when they saw it. Everything from furniture suites and candied fruit to commercial and residential architecture stressed the mission motif. Some of the missions themselves were restored as pioneer theme parks, especially San Gabriel Archangel, where a specially constructed theater next to the old church housed McGrory's mission play, the American Oberammergau, which was eventually seen by tens of thousands. At a New York advertising convention in the early 1930s, the mission aura of history and romance was rated as an even more important attraction in selling Southern California than weather or movie industry glamour. Of course, as Starr notes, this capitalization of Los Angeles's fictional Spanish past not only sublimated contemporary class struggle, but also censored and repressed from view the actual plight of Alta California's descendants. Pio Pico, the last governor of Mexican California and once the richest man in the city, was buried in a pauper's grave, virtually as Lummis's floral floats were passing down Broadway. From the middle 90s, Lummis edited the influential magazine Out West, Land of Sunshine, whose masthead reads like a who's who of California letters, and oversaw a full-fledged salon that gathered around his famous bungalow, El Alisal, along the rocky Arroyo Seco between Los Angeles and Pasadena, the famed winter retreat of Eastern millionaires. Lummis's Arroyo set regrouped Henry James's Yankee intelligentsia in an altogether more libidinal setting. Indeed, one of the set's major credos, best expressed in Grace Ellery Channing's evocations of an Italianized Southern California, was the power of sunshine to reinvigorate the racial energies of the Anglo-Saxons, Los Angeles as the New Rome, and so on. Lummis's passions for Southwest archaeology, he founded the famed Southwest Museum a few blocks from El Alisal, mission preservation, physical culture, emulating the imagined nightly lifestyle of the Dons, and racial metaphysics were recapitulated by other Arroyans. Thus, the retired tobacco manufacturer and essayist Abbot Kinney crusaded simultaneously for the Mission Indians, the mass planting of eucalyptus, citrus culture, the conservation of Yosemite Valley, and Anglo-Saxon racial purity through eugenics. As a speculator and developer, he also realized the supreme incarnation of the Mediterranean metaphor, Venice, California, with its canals and imported gondoliers. In a similarly polymathic vein, Joseph Whitney was an early president of the University of Southern California, a fervent booster, California of the South, 1888, and author of the epic Race Life of the Aryan Peoples, 1907, which argued that Los Angeles was destined to become the world capital of Aryan supremacy. Meanwhile, with the avid support of Otis, the doctrines of Nietzsche were being Southern Californianized by the Times' literary editor and Arroyan child prodigy, Willard Huntington Wright. Wright would later, as editor of the Smart Set, metamorphose from booster to debunker, repudiating Los Angeles's provincialism at every opportunity, while celebrating the invigorations of sexual promiscuity. The Arroyo set also defined the visual arts and architecture of turn-of-the-century Los Angeles. George Wharton James, a desert health faddist like Lummis, organized the Arroyo Guild, a short-lived but seminal point of intersection between the Mission Myth Romantics and the Pasadena franchise of the arts and crafts movement, dominated by the celebrated Green Brothers. A synthesis of the two currents, of course, was the typical craftsman bungalow, with its Navajo and Mission Oak interior decorations. If the ultimate bungalow was really a cathedral in wood, like the Green Brothers' incredible gamble house, affordable only by the very rich, the masses could buy small but still stylish imitations in do-it-yourself kits that could be thrown up on any vacant lot. For an entire generation, these democratic bungalows, with their domestic miniaturization of the Arroyo aesthetic, were praised not only for making Los Angeles a city of single-family homes, a staggering 94% of all dwellings by 1930, but also for assuring industrial freedom. Thus, when the United States Commission on Industrial Relations visited Los Angeles in 1914, it heard F.J. Ziendeler of the Merchants and Manufacturers Association brag that working-class home ownership was the keystone of the open shop and a contented labor force. Bitter union leaders, on the other hand, denounced the mortgage payments on the little bungalows as a new serfdom that made Los Angeles workers timid in the face of their bosses. The preeminence of the Arroyos set in defining the cultural parameters of Los Angeles's development, and in investing real estate speculation and class warfare with an aura of romantic myth, began to come to an end after World War I. Lummis's special relationship with Otis was not part of the inheritance that Harry Chandler took over in 1917. The Times's subsidy to Lummis was cut. The movies arrived as more effective promoters of immigration than the Land of Sunshine. And in any case, the Mission Romantics became older and more disenchanted in rapidly urbanizing and auto-congested Southern California. Taos and Carmel began to usurp the Arroyo's role as elite culture center of the Southwest. By the early 1920s, bungalows and rugged outdoor living were passing out of vogue. The upper middle classes, enriched by oil speculations or Hollywood, were preferring servants and massive Spanish colonial revival homes. Yet the upscale popularity of the Spanish colonial style testified to one of the two most durable legacies of the Arroyans. The creation of an ersatz history which, through its comprehensive incorporation into landscape and consumption, became an actual historical stratum in the culture of Los Angeles. Contemporary mini-malls and fast-food franchises with their Franciscan arches and red-tiled roofs are still quoting chapter and verse from the Mission myth, not to mention the Mission-style design of the new Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. The other major legacy, of course, was the ideology of Los Angeles as the utopia of Aryan supremacism, the sunny refuge of white Protestant America, in an age of labor upheaval and the mass immigration of the Catholic and Jewish poor from Eastern and Southern Europe. The Debunkers. It seems somehow absurd, but it is nevertheless a fact, that for 40 years the smiling, booming, sunshine city of the angels has been the bloodiest arena in the Western world for capital and labor. Moro Mayo. The weather is beautiful. The only words spoken by a wobbly before his arrest in the 1921 San Pedro free speech fight. One of these immigrants, and the first, at least among the non-Jews, to become a major American writer, was Louis Adamek. His personal odyssey carried him from Carniola in the Austro-Hungarian Empire to the mill towns of Pennsylvania, then with the American Expeditionary Force to the trenches of the Somme. Like so many other demobilized veterans, he decided to try his luck in Los Angeles, ending up broke and homeless in Pershing Square, as Old Central Park had just been renamed. What the Times would later call the 40-year war of capital and labor was drawing to its bitter close. The city's once powerful socialist movement, they came within a hair's breadth of the mayoralty in 1911, had retreated to Llano in the Mojave, while one AFL union after another had been broken in a succession of violent metal trade strikes and street transport lockouts. Only IWW seamen and longshoremen defied the Merchants and Manufacturers Association crusade to make the open shop complete. Adamek was swept up in this final battle of the local class war, befriending the IWW organizers and relishing their gallows humor and indiscipline, and ultimately recording their suicidal bravery in his Laughing in the Jungle, 1932, an autobiography of an immigrant in America that was also an extraordinary documentary of Los Angeles in the 1920s from the standpoint of its radical outcasts and defeated idealists. Adamek's epistemological position was curious. Although in his guts he sided with the IWW's doomed struggle, he remained intellectually aloof from their naive belief in revolution and one big union. As he put it, "I was not a regular socialist, but a Mencenite." He soon became part of a like-minded salon of Los Angeles bohemians, gravitating around book dealer Jack Zeitlin's home in Echo Park, that included architect Lloyd Wright, photographer Edward Weston, critic librarian Lawrence Clark Powell, artist Rockwell Kent, and a dozen others. Yet Adamick was also uncomfortable with these genteel rebels, as Carrie McWilliams, a young member of the circle, would later observe. He had an instinctive hostility to typically middle-class concepts. Eventually, he withdrew to a Slavic neighborhood in San Pedro, Los Angeles's bustling port. It was a normal seaport town. There were no tourists and sick old people from Iowa and Missouri. From this base in the harbor, with one foot in the literati camp, Mencken had begun to publish Adamick in the American Mercury, and the other in the Proletariat, Adamick chronicled Los Angeles of the oil and God crazy 1920s. To him, it was an incredible burlesque mirror of the philistinism and larceny of Coolidge America, additional proof of the accuracy of Marx's generalization that history repeats itself, first as tragedy and then as farce. As McWilliams recalled, he thrived on Los Angeles. He reveled in its freaks, fakirs, and frauds. He became the magazine biographer of such eccentrics as Ottoman Bar Azusht Ranish and M.A. Semple McPherson. Lost in the files of the strange assortment of magazines published by R. Haldeman Julius, will be found a long list of Adamick's contributions to Los Angeles. He was its prophet, sociologist, and historian. Adamick's most original contribution to the debunking of the booster myth was his emphasis on the centrality of class violence to the construction of the city. Others had already attacked Los Angeles's philistinism and skewered its apologists with Mencken-like sarcasm. Indeed, as early as 1913, Willard Huntington Wright was complaining in the Smart Set about the hypocrisy, like a vast fungus, that is spread over the city's surface. In his historically interesting but vapidly written 1927 novel, Oil, Upton Sinclair, who had been a leading participant in the IWW free speech fight at the harbor, debunked the oil boom and evoked the oppression of labor in Los Angeles. But Adamick was the first to carefully chart the sordid, bloody history of the 40-year war and attempt a muckraking reconstruction of its central events, the bombing of the Times in 1910, and the subsequent trial of the labor conspiracy led by the McNamara brothers. Dynamite, The Story of Class Violence in America, 1931, although scarcely flattering to the California labor bureaucracy, painted a demonic portrait of General Otis and the ruling class brutality that had driven labor to desperation. Equally, it warned readers in the early Depression years that, until employers bargained with unions in good faith, outbreaks of violent class warfare were inevitable. Shortly after publishing the first version of Dynamite, Adamick synthesized his various Haldeman Julius ephemera and pages from his diary in a famous essay, Los Angeles, There She Blows, The Outlook, 13 August 1930. Later quoted in the Enormous Village chapter of Laughing in the Jungle. This essay was widely noticed by the critical literati, exerting a seminal influence on McWilliams as well as upon Nathaniel West, who in The Day of the Locust, 1939, would further develop Adamick's image of Los Angeles's spirituality and mentally starving little people, the folks. Also impressed was writer and satirist Mauro Mayo, who paraphrased and amalgamated Adamick's outlook and McNamara pieces in his own Los Angeles, 1933. Although Laughing in the Jungle was the incomparably more powerful work, Mayo's lurid vignette-style history, for example, From Hell Hole of the West to The Hickman Horror, scored its own points against the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce. Mayo was particularly effective in reworking Adamick's Enormous Village theme. Here is an artificial city which has been pumped up under forced drought, inflated like a balloon, stuffed with rural humanity like a goose with corn, endeavoring to eat up this too rapid avalanche of anthropods. The sunshine metropolis heaves and strains, sweats, and becomes pop-eyed, like a young boa constrictor trying to swallow a goat. It has never imparted an urban character to its incoming population for the simple reason that it has never had any urban character to impart. On the other hand, the place has retained the manners, culture, and general outlook of a huge country village. Not all debunking of the enormous village was merely literary. The group of independent artists of Los Angeles, who held their first exhibition in 1923, represented an analogous, even earlier, critical current in local art. A united front for the new form, including cubism, dynamism, and expressionism, they attacked the landscape romantics, the eucalyptus painters, Laguna seascape painters, mission painters, and so on, who perpetuated Helen Hunt Jackson in watercolor. Dominated by the synchromist painter Stanton MacDonald Wright, who had caroused with the cubists in Paris before World War I, and the radical Lithuanian exile Boris Deutsch, the group of independents were transformed by their encounter with revolutionary Mexican muralism in the late 1920s. David Siqueiros, who passed through Los Angeles in the early Depression, contributed a famous lost work that was roughly the equivalent of Adamick's Dynamite in its Marxist view of Los Angeles history. Commissioned in 1930 to decorate Olvera Street, the contrived Mexican tourist precinct next to the old plaza, with a gay mural, Siqueiros instead painted Tropical America. A crucified peon under a snarling eagle evokes the imperial savagery at the origin of the Anglo occupation. Although quickly whitewashed by its shocked patroness, Siqueiros's great mural survived long enough to impress the young Jackson Pollock. Reportedly, echoes of its imagery entered his later work. Adamick's and Mayo's indictment of Los Angeles's fake urbanity, as well as the attack of the group of independents on landscape romanticism, simultaneously unearthed a truism and gave birth to a lasting stereotype. The anti-urban garden city ethos, celebrated by the Arroyans, was turned over to expose its malignant aspect. Intellectual émigrés, beginning to arrive in numbers from Europe in the early 1930s, were particularly disturbed by the absence of urban culture in a city region of 2 million inhabitants. Alfred Döblin, the famed literary portraitist of Berlin, would actually denounce Hollywood as a murderous desert of houses, a horrible garden city. When asked to comment on the suburban lifestyle, he added, "Indeed, one is much and extensively in the open here. Yet, am I a cow?" Unfortunately, Adamick was not around to add his voice to the disenchantment of the exiles, or alternatively to guide them to the saner working-class areas of the city which he knew so intimately. Awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship to pursue his writing on the new immigrants, he moved to New York at the beginning of the Depression. After his departure, the mantle of Los Angeles debunker passed to his friend, the lawyer, writer, and journalist Cary McWilliams. Adamick's profound influence upon McWilliams's view of Los Angeles was acknowledged in a small volume of essays, Louis Adamick and Shadow America, which the latter circulated in 1935. McWilliams reflected at length on Adamick's Mencken-esque critique of Los Angeles as America, as well as upon the margin of class consciousness and peasant sense that distinguished Adamick from other L.A. bohemians of the 1920s. McWilliams also registered some of his own, surprisingly left-wing opinions, including a reference to the daintily eclectic fascism of Mr. Roosevelt. A few years later, coincident with the sensation of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, 1939, McWilliams published his brilliant exposé of California agribusiness, Factories in the Field, that led to his appointment as Commissioner of Immigration and Housing by California's newly elected Democratic governor, Culbert Olson. Through the war years, McWilliams also kept up his leading role in the progressive politics of Los Angeles, organizing the defense for the East Side Chicanos framed in the infamous Sleepy Lagoon case of 1943, and reporting in The Nation and New Republic on the successful struggle to end the open shop. In 1946, as the culmination of nearly 20 years of literary and political engagement in the region, McWilliams published his magisterial Southern California Country, Island on the Land, as a volume in the American Folkway series edited by Erskine Caldwell. A self-described labor of love, Southern California Country completed the debunking project initiated by Adamick in his Los Angeles, There She Blows piece almost a generation before. It was a devastating deconstruction of the Mission myth and its makers, beginning with a recovery of the Mexican roots of Southern California and the seldom-told story of genocide and native resistance during the 1850s and 1860s. But McWilliams went far beyond L.A. bashing polemic or Mencken-esque condescension. Picking up where Adamick had left off in his narratives of Los Angeles labor, McWilliams sought to integrate historical narrative with economic and cultural analysis. Southern California country adumbrates a full-fledged theory of the singular historical conditions, ranging from militarized class organization to super-boosterism, that made possible the breakneck urbanization of Los Angeles without the concomitant development of a large manufacturing base or commercial hinterland. McWilliams carefully explained how this sociology of the boom was responsible for the city's anti-urban bias and sprawling form. It reflects a spectacle of a large metropolitan city without an industrial base. 3 years later, California, the great exception, placed the rise of Southern California within the larger framework of California's unique evolution as a civilization and social system. The year 1949 also saw the publication of his groundbreaking History of Mexican Immigration, North from Mexico, which restated, now on an epic scale, the fundamental contribution of Mexican labor and craft to the emergence of the modern Southwest. This magnificent quartet of books, together with earlier studies of California writers, Ambrose Bierce and Adamick, constitutes one of the major achievements within the American regional tradition, making McWilliams the Walter Prescott Webb of California, if not its Fernand Braudel. In his oeuvre, in other words, debunkery transcended itself to establish a commanding regional interpretation. But no McWilliams school followed. Southern California country was falsely assimilated into the guidebook genre, and, despite continuing popularity, produced little commentary and few progeny. The implicit political groundwork of McWilliams's writing, the labor reformist popular front in California, was demolished by Cold War hysteria. Called to New York to oversee an emergency civil liberties issue of The Nation, McWilliams stayed there for the next quarter of a century as the magazine's editor. Meanwhile, research on Southern California devolved once again into trivial genealogy or boosterism, until the late 1970s, with the appearance of Gottlieb and Wolt's massive History of the Times, fewer serious monographs, let alone synoptic studies, were annually produced about the region than of any other major metropolitan area. Virtually alone among big American cities, Los Angeles still lacks a scholarly municipal history, a void of research that has become the accomplice of cliché and illusion. The chapters that would update and complete Southern California country are absent. Los Angeles understands its past, instead, through a robust fiction called Noir. The Noirs. From Mount Hollywood, Los Angeles looks rather nice, enveloped in a haze of changing colors. Actually, and in spite of all the healthful sunshine and ocean breezes, it is a bad place, full of old, dying people who were born old of tired pioneer parents, victims of America, full of curious, wild, and poisonous growths, decadent religious cults and fake science, and wildcat enterprises, which, with their aim for quick profit, are doomed to collapse and drag down multitudes of people. A jungle. Louis Adamick. You can rot here without feeling it. John Retchie. In 1935, the famous radical author Louis Corey, nay Louis Fryna, announced in his Crisis of the Middle Class that the Jeffersonian dream was moribund. That middle-class ideal is gone beyond recall. The United States today is a nation of employees and of propertyless dependents. As jobless accountants and ruined stockbrokers stood in the same breadlines as truck drivers and steelworkers, much of the babbitry of the 1920s was left with little to eat except for obsolete class pride. Corey warned that the downwardly mobile middle stratum, at war with itself, was approaching a radical crossroads and would either turn towards socialism or fascism. This invocation of the dual immiseration and radicalization of the middle classes applied more literally and appositely to Los Angeles during the early 1930s than anywhere else in the country. The very structure of the long Southern California boom, fueled by middle-class savings and channeled into real estate and oil speculations, ensured a vicious circle of crisis and bankruptcy for the mass of retired farmers, small businessmen, and petty developers. Indeed, the absence of heavy industry, together with the deportation of tens of thousands of unemployed manual workers back to Mexico, meant that the depression in Los Angeles was foregrounded and amplified in the middle classes, producing a political fermentation that was at times bizarre. Political observers inured to the bedrock conservatism of Southern California's Midwest immigrants were incredulous in 1934 when Upton Sinclair, the region's most notorious socialist, captured more than 100,000 crossover Republican votes for his End Poverty in California, EPIC, program, with its quasi-revolutionary advocacy of production for use. In an interview 30 years later, Los Angeles EPIC organizer Reuben Burroughs confirmed that the movement primarily spoke to the broken-down middle class, with little attention to labor or to the unemployed. 4 years later, journalists were warning of the potential for local fascism as the voting tide switched toward the shadowy ham and eggs movement, with its weird combination of pension reform and brown shirt demagoguery. Agitated middle-class voters also embraced the temporary sensations of Technocracy Incorporated, the Utopian Society, and the Townsend Plan. Symptomatically, the epicenters of this turbulence were the suburban growth poles of the Roaring Twenties. Glendale, a hotbed of EPIC, and Long Beach, with 40,000 elderly Iowans, the birthplace of the Townsend Plan and stronghold of ham and eggs. These depression-crazed middle classes of Southern California became, in one mode or another, the original protagonists of that great anti-myth, usually known as noir. Beginning in 1934 with James M. Cain's The Postman Always Rings Twice, a succession of through-the-glass darkly novels, all produced by writers under contract to the studio system, repainted the image of Los Angeles as a deracinated urban hell. Riding against the myth of El Dorado, they transformed it into its antithesis, that of the dream running out along the California shore. They created a regional fiction obsessively concerned with puncturing the bloated image of Southern California as the golden land of opportunity and the fresh start. Noir was like a transformational grammar turning each charming ingredient of the Booster's Arcadia into a sinister equivalent. Thus, in Horace McCoy's They Shoot Horses, Don't They? 1935, the Marathon Dance Hall on Ocean Pier became virtually a death camp for the Depression's lost souls. The changeless, monotonous, beautiful days without end, unmarred by rain or weather, of William Faulkner's noir short story Golden Land, 1935, were a Sisyphean imprisonment for the matriarch of a Midwestern family corrupted by L.A. success. Similarly, Cain, in Double Indemnity, 1936, and Mildred Pierce, 1941, evoked poisoned bungalows whose white-walled, red-tiled normality, as good as the next and perhaps a little better, barely hid the murderous marriages within. In Nathaniel West's The Day of the Locust, 1939, Hollywood became the dream dump, a hallucinatory landscape tottering on apocalypse, while in successive Chandler novels, The Climate, Earthquake Weather, and mayhem-inspiring Santa Ana Winds was increasingly eerie. There were even ladies in the lakes. Collectively, the déclassé middle strata of these novels are without ideological coherence or capacity to act, except as McCoy's sleepwalkers or West's stampeding flea people. Individually, however, their petty bourgeois anti-heroes typically expressed autobiographical sentiments. As the noir of the 1930s and 1940s, and again in the 1960s, became a conduit for the resentments of writers in the velvet trap of the studio system. Thus, the very first hard-boiled Hollywood detective, Ben Jardine, the hero of a 1930s serial In the Black Mask, echoed the studio-weary cynicism of his creator, Raoul Whitfield, bit actor turned hack screenwriter. Likewise, Todd Hackett in The Day of the Locust is portrayed in a situation similar to West's own, brought to the coast by a talent scout for the studios, and forced to live the dilemma of reconciling his creative work with his commercial labors. Chandler's Marlowe, by the same token, symbolized the small businessman locked in struggle with gangsters, corrupt police, and the parasitic rich, who were usually his employers as well. A romanticized simulacrum of the writer's relationship to studio hacks and moguls. Bud Schulberg, on the other hand, examined the exploitative relationship between writer and mogul from the top down. A studio brat, son of Paramount's production chief, turned communist writer, he portrayed Hollywood's capitalism with almost documentary realism in What Makes Sammy Run, 1940. Sammy Glick, the rising young mogul, battens off the creativity of the friends and employees whom he in turn betrays and crushes. As one of Schulberg's characters observes, he is the id of our society. Schulberg's psychoanalytic perspective, however, was exceptional. One of the distinguishing traits of first-generation Los Angeles fiction was its emphasis on economic self-interest rather than depth psychology. Thus, something like the labor theory of value supplied a consistent moralizing edge in the novels of Chandler and Kane. There is a constant tension between the productive middle class, Marlowe, Mildred Pierce, Nick Papadakis, and so on, and the unproductive déclassé, or idle rich, the Sternwoods, Burt Pierce, Monty Barragán, and so on. Unable to accumulate any longer through speculation or gambling, or having lost their inheritance, or merely desiring to speed it up, the noir déclassé invariably choose murder over toil. Invariably, too, the fictional opposition between these different middle strata suggests the contrast between the lazy, speculative Southern California economy, real estate promotions, and Hollywood, and America's hard-working heartlands. These motifs of the 1930s Los Angeles novel, the moral phenomenology of the depraved or ruined middle classes, the insinuation of the crisis of the semi-proletarianized writer, and the parasitical nature of Southern California, underwent interesting permutations in the film noir of the 1940s. Sometimes film noir is described in shorthand as the result of the encounter between the American hard-boiled novel and exiled German expressionist cinema, a simplistic definition that leaves out other seminal influences, including psychoanalysis and Orson Welles. For our purposes, however, what was significant was the way in which the image of Los Angeles was reworked from novel to screenplay, sometimes incestuously, as in Chandler rewriting Kane or Faulkner rewriting Chandler. Then translated to the screen by such leftist auteurs noir, some of them émigrés, as Edward Dimitrik, Ring Lardner Jr., Ben Maddow, Carl Foreman, John Barry, Jules Dassin, Abraham Polonsky, Albert Maltz, Dalton Trumbo, and Joseph Losey. In their hands, film noir sometimes approached a kind of Marxist cinema manqué, a shrewdly oblique strategy for an otherwise subversive realism.